Welcome to Office Hours. I'm David Meltzer. We're here live at the SiriusXM studios at the Wynn in Las Vegas. And we are blessed because this guy blew me away the very first time I ever met him. And now he is owning Manhattan, if you haven't seen on Netflix, as the executive producer and star of one of my favorite real estate shows, three-time best-selling author, but just a great person with a great personality. Ryan Serhant, thank you for taking the time to come back to Office Hours.
Thanks for having me. I think this is an honor. It's definitely the highlight of my week.
Thank
for sure.
You. Well, good. One of the things, there's two things that stood out. When first we met, you were a Bravo star. And I remember telling my guys, hey, you know, is this really aligned? Like, I really don't need another housewife on my show. I want depth. I want knowledge. I want wisdom. And I meet this guy, Ryan Serhant, for the first time. And this is maybe 10 years ago. It's a while. And I am blown away. Every question I have, his answers exceed my expectations. I still remember, and I've quoted him a million times, you know, you don't want to sell, you want to shop with your friends. You don't want to sell your friend. You want to go shopping with your friends. And I'm thinking the wisdom that this guy has, and then to build a brand in a community, was far beyond an expectation that I had, even after meeting him, to think about the dynasty that he's created. Ryan, you know, you were like a contractor's son, and you literally could have starred in the Barbie movie as Ken. You are so talented, charismatic, smart, but you know, you're an extremely good business person, which is a rarity with all of those other talents. Usually people start cheating themselves when things should be easy because they're good looking, smart, and charismatic. What do you think it was that kept driving you to be a successful business person in everything you do, from the Netflix shows to your own real estate empire? You're just a great business person.
I appreciate you saying that. I guess we'll let the history books decide if your statements are accurate or not.
And I'll humble, by the way.
You know, what I'll say is I made a decision early on in my career to choose success first. Sure, when I first came to New York City in 2006, I thought it was going to be through theater, but I never treated it as a one-lane highway. It was my main choice of roads, even though there was lots of roads and lots of traffic and lots of detours. And I think that was a big differentiator for me. I worked with so many people, especially early in my career, who just have this thing in their mind, that's what they're going to do. And when it doesn't work out, it's a brick wall. And they turn the car around, right? They go the opposite way down that highway, where for me, nothing was ever a brick wall. It was a speed bump. It was a swamp, you know? It was a storm. And so when theater didn't work out, it's like, well, I'm still on the success road. I guess it's not going to be the left turn. Maybe I take a right turn. What's on the right turn? Oh, get my real estate license to pay my rent. That's weird. I don't think I really like that. Let me try it. Okay. Yes. And I just yes anded my way every time I saw some kind of personal product market fit. You know, and in the later stage of my business, it was about then taking those market fits and just expanding upon them. Right? Like you're lucky enough if you can find kind of one thing you're okay at, let alone three things. And I've just never let up that relentless pursuit of success in whatever version it might come into. Like, you know, we just raised money for the first time ever for a technology company. If you had told me 4 years ago, 3 years ago, I'd be doing that, I would have said that's not on my success road.
Right.
It'd be a different turn though. And here we are.
And I will tell you, with all the billionaires, millionaires, entrepreneurs, celebrities, athletes, entertainers that I've worked with over 35 years, Ryan has, both Ryans, by the way, and the other co-hosts, but both Ryans particularly, you can see it, have this common denominator that they must be what they can be. You know, no matter what, it's in their mind. If I'm going to be this, I must be what I can be, which is that limitless attitude. Brianna, meet my friend, Ryan Serhant.
Ryan, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I've actually been in your orbit a little bit over the years. Obviously, you would not know me, but I'm glad to meet you today. I was really excited to here the product, the personal product market fit that you mentioned. And I know that you are a huge fan of using social media as a business tool. And, you know, in the past decade or more, have explored that in various different ways for yourself. What do you think is the most, I guess, underutilized aspect of social media today? And where do you think like personal branding and social media is going in the future?
I don't think I'm the be-all end-all for social, but to answer that question as best I possibly can, I would say I view social not as entertainment, but as infrastructure. I think social used to be optional marketing. Now I think it is, and this is not news, it is required customer acquisition. And I'm not the first person to say that attention is the most valuable currency in business today. Obviously, it is. Everything is about attention, whether it's Google sitting at a table, deciding what their company was going to be and ranking pages, right? Page rank by attention, which website gets the most page views. That's the website we're going to put to the top of Google. How we view the internet. The first white paper on artificial intelligence was about capturing attention. The whole world moves towards attention. And I think every business, though now, why I say infrastructure, is competing with creators, not just individual competitors. And social compresses that trust-building timeline really dramatically. And so, you know, for me, in the real estate business, you know, we are hyper-focused here. Before social, it was local reputation, boots on the ground. Who could you meet within a 10-block radius? You know, today, it's global visibility that creates local authority.
Yeah.
And I think one piece of content can, you know, it generates leads, it recruits talent, it attracts investors, it closes listings, it creates partnerships. And so it's incredibly important. And I tell young people all the time, like, you don't have to use social, but you will be beat by an agent who does.
Yeah.
Same thing with AI. You know, I don't think AI replaces salespeople. It will replace those who don't use it, though.
Yeah. I love the setting the trust infrastructure. I think that's such a good reframe to think about what it is that you're doing when you're out there instead of just talking about what you're doing on Saturday night.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think in the nuance and duality of the people that are using AI or using social, David, one of the things that we talk about is what you pay attention to gives you and have an infrastructure for only so you can give intention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this intentional behavior, having a definiteness of purpose intertwined with understanding who's paying attention to what and utilizing these tools intentionally can create the coincidences or the coinciding, as you have written the book about, intention and understanding frequency and vibration. Obviously, you feel the frequency of our friend here.
Yeah, I'm definitely talking to a superhuman.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I love it. I always talk about the law of momentous return. I don't even know if that's a word, but I use it anyways.
It's two words.
And but yeah, I love how you said, Ryan, look, I was on this and, you know, it was a speed bump. I didn't turn around. And that's kind of my whole law of momentous return. But I love the way that you depicted it. Is so many people, they get that headway and they don't pivot. They don't shift. They don't look at the options where they're at. And it's like, look, I'm on the success road and I'm shooting for the moon and I might end up on, you know, the Swiss Alps or Everest, but I'm on this path. And you've done some amazing things. And I draw out that amazing because I love, I'm reading about you and I've read about you and I've seen you a little bit on online. And I'm just curious because in my whole superhuman development and doing my best to try to be superhuman and at the same time help other people achieve it, I have a thing called, it's called the AM/PM game. And just looking at you, I want to know, what does Ryan Serhant's AM/PM game look like? Because I'm absolutely curious. When do you get up? What are your non-negotiables? And what is this insane rhythm that you've created to create such a wonderful lifestyle and impact?
It's funny. The content that I've done sparingly about my daily routine has probably been some of the most divisive stuff that I've put out there.
You can thank me later.
Just because it's there's a love-hate relationship with structure. You know, like part of the world believes in goal setting, structuring your day, moving forward towards goals, being rhythmic with how you use your time. The other part of the world is we're only going to live here once. Everyone's going to die. Must be happy. So on. And like finding that balance is definitely hard. And there's some days that I don't like my routine. And there's some days where I'm like, thank God I have a routine. Harvard reached out to me a couple years ago and said, we're going to publish a case study about you. And I assumed it was like, okay, content to commerce, right? We figured out in 2014 how to sell luxury goods using social at zero CAC. It's the whole reason we did it, right? I want zero CAC. Yeah. I want to rebrand the gross margin in our business. And I never want to buy a lead ever in my entire life. And we still have never done that. And they said, no, that's not the most interesting. You know what's interesting? How you structure your day. It's like, is that real? And there is. Can you see? I can't see. Do you see there's the frame right there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is a, I'll fix it later. This is Harvard Business School. I don't know if you can see
that's so good. Yes.
Ryan Serhant, time management for repeatable success about my 1,000-minute rule. Because I brought, you're going to regret asking me this question.
You're going to regret it.
Because when I first got into sales, there's no boss. You're by yourself. Yeah. And especially as an entrepreneurial salesperson, 1099 independent contractor, what do you do all day? Like at 8 a.m., 9 p.m., your a.m. and your p.m., what do you do? How do you stay happy but also get towards success? Do I make phone calls? What do I do? And so I broke my day down into three buckets. I called them find business, keep business, do business. For finder, keeper, doer, super simple. Like I think simplicity is sophistication, right? Simplification is sophistication, as Steve Jobs said, but it is true. And then I was like, okay, how many minutes do I have from the moment I start Finder to the end of Doer? It's about 1,000, roughly. Everyone's life is different. There are single moms out there with six kids who don't have 1,000 minutes to be productive. But on average, you have 1,440 minutes a day, 1,000 of them. You can be somewhat productive. And when I was getting into the business, it's like, how do I use those minutes wisely? And also, how do I spend my minutes like I spend money? Because I don't want to be wasteful of minutes. I don't want to book a half an hour or an hour meeting.
Yeah.
That's 30 to 60 minutes for a 2-minute conversation or for an email or for a text message, unless it's an investment into tomorrow's minutes or the minutes after or the minutes after. I also don't want to be sad or depressed or have my week ruined or my day ruined if someone fucks up some of my minutes. I have a bad phone call or something terrible happens, you know? It's like, oh, that ruined my day. She ruined my day. It's like, well, I wouldn't throw out $985 if someone stole 15 of them from me. And that's obviously barring life tragedy and all that. And so to answer your question now, as simply as I possibly can, if I'm in New York, right, my home base, because when I'm traveling, it's all over the place. But if I'm in my home base, I wake up at 4:30. I do email and text from about 4:30 to 5:30. I work out from 5:30 to 7. I get the hardest part of my day out of the way first. And I also send a lot of the day's messages as early as possible. So when everyone else wakes up and gets them, they know that I'm already beating them at life. Then I go to work. I'm in the car by 7:30. And I'm roughly booked on the 15-minute mark for the most part, just like this session, you know, and I try to keep it as efficiently as possible. And it's kind of like, you know, Parkinson's law, not Parkinson's disease, but Parkinson's law basically says that however much time you set for yourself to complete a task, it'll take you exactly that amount of time. If you give yourself a year to clean out your closet, it's going to take you a damn year.
Yeah.
If you give yourself till 5 o'clock, you will find a way. And so I find it to be that much more productive during the day if people know, oh, wait, we only have Okay, I only have 15 minutes. All right, so let's cut to the chase. You still have time to get to know, like, it's all there. I don't know. Maybe when I'm 80, I'm going to be on my deathbed and be like, fucking stupid minute rule.
That's the way I feel, man.
No, you're going to have
it'll be like 100
you're
going
to have a bunch of
it won't be 80.
Memories.
It won't be able to be 100 and something, but I love time philosophy. Time's my love language. Ryan, you have been like nervously chomping at the bit. I know you probably have a million things on your mind. This is a conversation. I'd pay to see this.
Yeah,
way
you know,
better hair than me.
There we go. Yeah, last time I was at your office, I had green hair, and I will attest to the time rule that you're talking about.
The last time I saw you, I think was in Vegas, and you had red hair.
Yeah, I forgot where we were. We did an impromptu podcast in the green room. I forgot.
Yeah.
I think it was in Texas. I can't remember.
Yeah, you've always been super nice to me, and I've always appreciated it very much.
No, I appreciate you. But I will say the time thing is true. I watched you in New York when we were at your office. I think you had just started the brokerage, too. And it was just bam, 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 one thing after another. But I got a real estate question, okay? We're talking about life, but the real estate market is very crazy right now. Lots of changes happening, you know, and I think two of them are affecting you, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts. One is the consolidation of brokerages. You're seeing this play out everywhere. And then the second is the market. I mean, we've had the lowest transaction volume, you know, in a long time, and agents are freaking out. It's tough for investors. You know, what do you think is going to happen with all this in the coming years?
Let me tackle it in order, I guess I'll say. The consolidation of brokerages is tied to the absorption of the market the way you just called out. We're probably going to have still less than 4.5 million trades this year nationally, right? We're not talking internationally right now. If we just talk about the United States. We're at historic lows because 1 in 5 Americans right now not only don't think they can't afford a house, they don't think home ownership is in the cards for them anymore. 1 in 5. That is a new statistic. So who's buying these houses? Yes, we have an inventory shortage. Yes, there's not enough homes. Yes, first-time home buyers have an affordability crisis, not a housing crisis. Everyone who needs a house has a house. There's houses. It's an affordability problem. But who's going to buy them if 1 in 5 think that homeownership is out of the realm of reality now? Which brings me to question number one, which is the consolidation. A lot of these firms have to consolidate. Anywhere had $3 billion in debt. From the day they were put together by Apollo to the day they sold a couple months ago to Compass, they'd never gotten out from under it. That company existed to service that debt. And the private equity shop that put them together did A-OK. And it was fine, right? They, hundreds of thousands of people, it's fine. That company had to sell. There was no way around it. And the only buyer out there waited until the price was right and bought them. And that's exactly what happened. And you're seeing that across the board right now as well. Redfin had to sell. There was no world in which Redfin did not sell to somebody. And selling to Rocket, the singular buyer where it made sense, was the way to go. You're going to see more of it. There are private equity firms right now who are trying to do greater roll-ups because transaction volume is at an all-time low. They think that they can use low transaction volume, which equates to low revenues, historically speaking, which will equate to, therefore, lower multiples. So you can get companies at better prices. But you're also seeing consolidation over an innovation, right? Like a lot of times when innovation slows, consolidation grows. Like there's a reason why that rhymes. Because if you don't know what else to do, you just buy. Let's just, you know what? I'm not sure I know what I'm doing. You're not sure you know what you're doing. So you know what? We should marry. and that's what you see happen. I don't know of a whole lot of examples of companies where growth and combination ended up really, really equating in a better customer experience. And so that's why you're seeing a lot of consolidation, mostly because the market's demanding it of certain companies that need to sell. And because volume is so low, pricing is finally roughly right. And a lot of people are pricing in the future. Like, are we going to stay at 4 million trades per year forever? I don't know. The 10-year is very high today, and 30 years are inching up towards 7% right now, like literally as we're speaking. I think it's like at 6.5, 6.6, something like that. It's a lot. It's expensive, which speaks to like the broader marketplace. I think we're waiting for something to break. And the problem is most people don't want what's needed to lighten the market, to bring more homes to the market, to bring interest rates down. You don't want either of those things. The last time we had a flood of inventory and low rates came a plague. Right. Before that, the last time we got a ton of inventory hitting the market and low interest rates came the great financial crisis. The last time before that, we had a ton of inventory and low rates came a terrorist attack on New York City. So like everybody wants more inventory. Everyone wants low rates so that we can incentivize home builders and we can create greater housing starts. But no one wants the reason we get those.
Right.
Shit. I don't know. I think we're entering a bifurcated housing market where affordability and luxury are just going to move in opposite directions. And we'll see where we shake out. I could talk to you for like 50 hours about this. I'm trying to be efficient with our minutes.
I know your time's valuable too, but that's super helpful.
That wouldn't be aligned with the time advice, but I will tell you, I think of the Latin quote, res ipsa loquitur, when I think of Ryan Serhant. That which speaks for itself. My friend, thank you so much for all the golden nuggets. Thank you for your friendship. Thank you for your time. I look forward to doing this more often, hopefully, at least seeing you when we're in New York. The incredible Ryan Serhant. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you all. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Aloha, brother.
Awesome, man. Keep it up.